Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I had a really strong cup of tea just a little while ago to try and counteract the effects of Thanksgiving dinner. So if the words come out too rapidly, just let me know. I've been really enjoying listening to all of the talks so far on this retreat from Lumpa and Debbie Ajahn Yanako, and listening also, hearing the questions that people have. It's always a rich time on a retreat like this to be sort of swimming in it on kind of a concentrated way, and also being able to just have more periods for meditation practice, formal meditation practice, because hearing the teachings with a quieter mind, it just seems to penetrate much more deeply. We get lots of opportunities at the monastery for this as well, but just coming together with such a large group of people, all with a tremendous amount of sincerity and clear interest and commitment, it's very inspiring. Just reflecting on some of the teachings that we've been listening to, some of the questions and answers, it occurs to me that there's a couple of major intentions that are in operation with our practice. One is the kinds of practices that are associated with what maybe could be referred to as picking up kinds of practices, and the other is more around the lines of letting go kinds of practices. So picking up and letting go are two qualities or forces that I see playing in our meditation and Dhamma practice. We've been talking a lot about picking up skillful reflections, picking up skillful habits, and letting go of unskillful habits, and letting go of unskillful practices of different kinds. So it's this combination of the two, those two forces. Can see it along the lines of different actions, trying to increase the picking up of skillful actions of body, speech, the precepts, the support of knowing what right action is all about, and picking them up in skillful ways. And then letting go of the unskillful kinds of actions that we find ourselves engaged in, all with the background of mindfulness to help us keep our mind focused in that direction. Same with mental states. We've been talking a lot about the picking up and reinforcement of skillful mental states. Like just this morning, when Paul was talking about wisely reflecting on, the quality of gratitude, picking that up as an act of reflection, picking it up as a mind state that we want to develop and encourage. And there's many of those kinds of practices that are just part of the path. The picking up of the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, bringing those as to full development as we can, picking up of practices to help settle and concentrate and deepen the stillness of the mind, providing a place of refuge for nourishment, for deep settling, clear seeing, picking up those kinds of mental states, and then letting go of the ones that obstruct us, letting go of the mental states like the five hindrances we talked about earlier in the retreat. So these picking up and letting go of these different kinds of practices help develop the mind, develop the heart, and provide a focus, a refuge for ourselves, for our practice, for our attention, because there's so much that we talk about needing to set aside to realize Dhamma. The act of renunciation, the act of giving up old habits and old ways of trying to find satisfaction, gratification, it's not easy because we're all looking for some peace and some pleasure, some pleasurable aspects of life. But we're looking for happiness, and we're realizing that the old ways of doing that just don't cut the mustard anymore. And it can be a bit, could cause a bit of despair if there's nothing else to substitute. So that's what we are doing with a lot of the practice of picking up skillful mental habits with our meditation practice, finding some sort of pleasure that's more refined than what we're usually caught up in, finding some sort of place to put our attention that's not only pleasurable, but is also leading in a skillful direction, one that will help us understand how we've come to where we are and how we can realize a bit more of a very permanent and stable sense of freedom and peace. So that's what we're doing with the development of the mind, the development of the meditation practice. Probably, a good majority of our time practicing Dhamma is spent around these two aspects of practice, the development of skillful actions and the abandoning of unskillful actions, the development of skillful mind states, the abandoning of unskillful mind states. This is where we need to spend a lot of our practice time. It's also, I think, useful to and necessary to frequently bring up some of the reflections that are, as the Buddha says, peculiar to his teaching. We chanted the other night in English the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And it's very useful to pick up reflection, consideration of those teachings as well, particularly as the mind is settling and experiencing some of the peacefulness of being in a quiet setting and being in a container like this. The mind will settle down and be much more open to and impressionable with recollection of the three characteristics. And as we all know, it's the really deep reflection upon and insight into penetration of the three characteristics that provide the pathway to the doors of the deathless. It's a reflection or a series of reflections that our teachers encourage us to actually make as part of our whole frame of reference. Ajahn Chah, in many of his teachings, you'll see, he just pretty much right from the get-go starts with telling us to just, as experiences arise in the mind and in our lives, to just put them all into the rubbish bins of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, to see all conditions as impermanent, as unsatisfactory, as not self. So we pick it up as a perception. We don't immediately experience it at the level of insight or deep penetration, but we pick it up as a perception for recollection, as a skillful means to not only familiarize ourselves with it on a cognitive level, intellectual level, but also just to start orienting ourselves around those themes so that more and more, little by little, it just becomes part of the habitual nature of our mind to reflect on things within that context through, as Lungpa often uses the words, through the lens of Dhamma, seeing experience through the lens of Dhamma, through the characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta. And gradually, over time, and the deepening of our commitment and practice, then that becomes more and more how we default to viewing things, or at least if we get lost, we know where to come back to if we've repetitively reflected on these three characteristics. So it's just a matter of training, a matter of redirecting attention in an appropriate way to see things through this different perspective. There's a lot of different levels that one can contemplate and experience these particular reflections. One of the reflections or chants that we often do, Debbie mentioned in her talk when she was talking about her experiences with her mother. And she brought up the chant that we often do in funeral circumstances around anicca, anicca vata sankhara, that chant. And one of the lines in it, the third line, which is upajitwa nirujanti, not too long ago, I saw a different translation of it from Ajahn Tanisro, Ajahn Jeff, that I really appreciated, and it's a way of translating that also Lungpa has referred to in different talks and also in one of his chapters in the book Nibbana, on Nibbana, the island. The way that Ajahn Jeff translates that third phrase, well, first of all, just to remind one that the first line is inconstant are all compounded things. So in reference to all compounded things, they have the nature, their nature is to arise and to cease. And then this third line, upajitwa nirujanti, he translates says, they disband as they are arising. And then the last line, of course, is in their stilling is bliss. But they disband as they are arising is a way that really brings it into the present moment to describe the present moment experience of inconstancy. I think it was Lungpa who was telling me once that a friend of his they were talking about the law of impermanence, and he was saying, well, of course, yeah, everything's impermanent. That's, you know, that's obvious. That's a no-brainer. But as he was pointing out, you know, like that's seeing it only on a very one kind of shallow level. But that the real deep penetration, deep experience of inconstancy, anicca, is in this moment-to-moment recognition of the inherent within the arising of any compounded or conditioned phenomena is its disbanding. And in fact, it's just happening right there. As it's arising, it is disbanding. And I've always found that just a great perception to just spend time with. to reflect on that, and in the quiet moments of meditation, to bring that up, to try and see one's experience right in the moment as disbanding, just as it's arising, that cessation and arising are part of the same process. I was having a discussion a little while ago, a month or two ago, with someone at the monastery, someone very keen on practice and strong aspiration to go forth. Excuse me. And he was saying how he doesn't really get much out of the reflection on anicca. It doesn't seem to really say much to him or grab him anyway. He's more of an anatta guy. Yeah. And it's interesting. You know, I think everyone can relate to that in some ways. Like, you know, when we're considering the three characteristics, oftentimes there's one particular reflection, whether it's anicca, dukkha, anatta, that seems to kind of be a stronger doorway, maybe a stronger entry for many of us. So, you know, some people are anicca people and some people are dukkha people and some people are anatta people. He's an anatta person. And he was saying, yeah, I can really, you know, really see the not-self characteristics of phenomena. It just makes a lot of sense. You know, it's just, you know, it's all impersonal experiences happening one after another. You know, really, you know, I just really don't have a sense that there's any agent at work. It's just this kind of, you know, patterns of mind states kind of playing themselves out, and that the solution is just, you know, to let it happen and not, you know, not get too involved with it, and to kind of you know, set back at a distance and let it play itself out and don't do anything stupid kind of thing. Those weren't his exact words. I paraphrase a little bit. But. And he said, but yeah, you know, the anicca thing, it just, you know, it just doesn't resonate as much to look at. And we got into kind of a long discussion that got to be a bit convoluted, so, and we ended up dropping it just because it was getting to be too intellectual and heady. But essentially, it was along the lines of he wasn't really sure about the law of karma, because if there's really no, you know, if there's really no self, then, you know, how can there be any kind of intention arising to cause certain mind states to arise, or certain qualities to develop, or certain actions to take place, and that it was all just kind of seemingly much more not random, but just a patterns of conditions arising and ceasing according to their own nature. And I was trying to kind of argue that you don't have to have an agent or a sense of self for there to be intention, and that sometimes people confuse intention with self. And you know, so we were going back and forth and finally decided to stop talking about it because I wasn't going anywhere. But it kind of occurred to me that maybe one of the things that was missing in the whole experience for him, and why he wasn't really appreciating the teachings around anicca so much, was just a couple of things. One was holding on to the not-self teaching as more of what Lungpa was talking about, the differences a little bit the other day, that holding on to more of a no-self kind of a teaching. There is no self, so there is no agent, there is no, you know, results of action, because there isn't anybody doing it, that kind of a thing, rather than picking it up as a strategy, as a not-self strategy for reflection, for consideration, and seeing where it takes us. More that than as a doctrine of, you know, metaphysics in some way, of And that perhaps you know, not being able to see sort of the momentary nature of anicca right here, not having quite yet the depth of meditation experience, which, you know, to be honest, probably most of us don't have to that level of really, really deep penetration either, but are working on. And because it seems to me, at least as I understand the teachings, at some point in our practice and our understanding, as we penetrate deeper and deeper, all three characteristics start to merge together, and they really are just different ways of looking at the same thing, the lens of Dhamma, if you really have a deep penetration and understanding of, say, anatta, then necessarily you also see, understand, appreciate on a very deep level the characteristics of dukkha and anicca. That they're, as I was saying, they're just, you know, looking at the same thing from a slightly different angle, slightly different characteristics of the same understanding experience. So that if one sees really deeply in the moment, in periods of deep quiet, really sees the disbanding and arising of phenomena, the disbanding and arising of the mind states and mental objects, anything that moves, essentially, then one just will automatically understand the not-self nature of that experience, and also understand automatically the unsatisfactoriness of taking refuge in those, in any kind of compounded or conditioned experience. It's also fleeting and temporal and inconstant, there's just no reason, no interest, the passion or enchantment with the conditioned realm just starts to fall away by itself if one sees these conditions in their true nature. There's a number of suttas that, of course, you know, refer to this development of penetration, development of insight into the three characteristics. And there's a few of them that are also, I found, as I read them and look at them and think about them, very, very much reinforcing of this kind of integrated nature of these as recollections, as these come together in our practice. And one of them is the teaching from Kaimukha, who was a monk who was, at the time of this story anyway, this sutta was very ill, not bearing up well, and there were some other monks, elder monks, who had heard that he was ailing and were worried that he was going to pass away without their getting a chance to talk with him. So they sent a messenger to question him a bit and ask him, you know, how he was doing in his practice and how his health was, what was going on, and if he'd had any particular insights. He reports to the messenger that he isn't bearing up very well, after all, and things aren't going all that well with his health, but that, at least in regard to his practice, he offers his reflection that he does not, at this point, regard any of the five khandhas as self or as belonging to self. He doesn't regard form as self or belonging to self. He doesn't regard feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, consciousness as self or belonging to self. And so the messenger goes back and reports that to the other monks, and they send the messenger back to Kamaka and say, you know, wow, does this mean you're an arahant? You've really fully penetrated, the truth, and your work is done. And Kamaka responds, and he says, well, I didn't say that. I just don't hold. The notion I am in regard to form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. You know, I just don't have that, form, but I don't have that notion, but I'm still, but I still do not regard myself as an arahant. So the messenger goes back and reports this to the group of monks, and the monks come back yet with another question, and this kind of goes back and forth for a little while with him trying to explain his, understanding and where he's at, and the other monks constantly having more questions. And finally Kamaka gets a bit annoyed. Maybe he doesn't get annoyed, but he gets a little bit frustrated and says, okay, enough of this. Let me just go there. Enough of this going back and forth. And so he pulls himself up and goes and talks with the other group of monks and tries to explain how he can... not regard the five khandhas in relation to any concept of self, but still not be completely liberated. And he goes on to explain this because the conceit, I am, there's still an underlying tendency or a feeling, a desire that moves along those lines, even though he doesn't associate it with any particular one aggregate of existence. There still is this underlying tendency, this desire, a feeling of the conceit, I am, that's still in existence. And then he goes on and offers a couple of similes that help to explain that. Which I think really, again, points out to some of the real subtle levels of this this sense, this perception of self. That's what self is. It's a perception, and how subtle it runs throughout our experience. And he uses the simile of a flower. First of all, he says that if you have a flower, does the scent of the flower belong to the petals, or does it belong to the pistils or the stamens or the stem or the leaves? And they say, well, it doesn't really belong to any one of them. It belongs to the whole flower. And then similarly, he uses another simile of a cloth that has been stained and soiled and is washed repetitively, thoroughly, with some sort of lye or cleansing agent, and it comes out pure, it comes out clean, but yet it still has a scent or an odor of that lye or that detergent that was making it clean, and that it's only after some time of storing it in a scented casket that all traces of the cleansing agent will disappear. And so he says that, it's similar, that this underlying tendency towards the conceit I am lingers even after a lot of understanding and insight has gelled in one's experience. And then he says through this process of repetitively just going back with the recollections and reflections on watching the arising and ceasing nature of form, the arising and ceasing nature of feeling, of perception, mental formations, consciousness, watching them over and over again in their arising and ceasing patterns, and that practice, that reflection, over a long period of time, eventually the conceit I am will then fade away, and a person will come to full understanding, full realization. And in the course of his actually explaining this process to the other monks, he himself becomes fully enlightened and becomes an arhat in the process of explaining it. And so I think that's a lovely story of how those two, particularly those two characteristics, impermanence and the reflections on inconstancy, reflections on anicca and anatta, kind of meld together in their fruition at the same point, at the same place. The reflection on one supports the understanding of the other. There's also another teaching that kind of pulls these characteristics together too, and it's one that I think it's one probably that many people are familiar with, a very beautiful short discourse when Kacchanagota goes to the Buddha and is asking him some questions about sort of various philosophical stances of the day, basically the often the two ways that people will kind of define their understanding of the experienceable world, one in terms of eternalism as a philosophical standpoint, and the other is annihilationism as a philosophical standpoint. And not to go through the whole explanation of the discourse, but basically the Buddha says, if one fully sees the arising of phenomena, then one can't take a stance on annihilationism. You know, if you can't say that nothing exists if you clearly see that phenomena arise. And you can't fully take on the stance of eternalism, that it, existence is continuous and based on a solid self, if you see the characteristic of cessation, so that there's no way you can take a stance on eternalism if you clearly see the experience in its cessation mode. So basically he says, that neither of those two philosophical stances are valid if one is clearly seen correctly, the arising and ceasing of phenomena. And basically he then goes to say that, the world is dependent on taking these stances. The world of the mind gravitates into these kinds of philosophical beliefs, ways of viewing the world, and the ways that we habitually act in the world, based on this craving adherence to these kinds of standpoints. And that for one who sees correctly the arising and ceasing, then what becomes apparent to them is that it's only dukkha that is seen as arising, merely arising, and it's only dukkha that is merely ceasing. That is how one correctly sees the world of experience, through this lens of Dhamma. And that one takes no stance, no adherence on self as a result of that. So he's bringing those characteristics together again, that really, if one is looking through the lens of Dhamma, looking at experience from that angle of the three characteristics, all that arises is dukkha. All that ceases is dukkha. When we look with confusion at the world in our experience, and we don't see it clearly in its true nature, then there is this experience of unsatisfactoriness, this this dissonance in our experience. And you can see that in moments of deep quiet, too. I think when you're really quietly watching the activities of the mind and certain mind states arise, you can see that when your attention goes out to it and you become involved with it, when greed or aversion or confusion grabs hold of an experience in mind, the tension that occurs in the deep layers of the mind, the unsatisfactoriness, that's really what I think the experience of dukkha on a deep level is that just that dissonance that one experiences when the mind goes out in either desire or aversion, or just isn't seen clearly. There's a dissonance in the mind, dukkha arising. And that when one is more clear about that process and is able to just see these different experiences arising without grasping hold of them, going after them with either desire for a pleasurable or experience or aversion of an unpleasant experience, then the mind settles. Any tendency towards attaching or holding on to an experience will not happen, that the mind just relinquishes the experience, does not hold on to it, and that there is peace in that. There's the cessation of dukkha, the dissonance that one feels relaxes, the grip is loosened, and there's a sense of peace. So it's in that not holding on to, that not grasping, and the seeing in that moment of disbanding as experiences arise, that there is this understanding of the cessation of dukkha. And also, I think, even though it's not pointed out explicitly in that particular discourse, then one can see that there is clearly an opportunity for the awareness of the not-self nature of the experience to become very apparent. There's nothing worth grasping onto as mine, nothing worth holding onto as who I am, because it does arise and cease just in that moment. And without the grasping, there's no dissonance. There's no reason to hold. There's no reason to be enchanted with the experience. There's, as we were talking about, as Ajahn Pasana was talking about earlier, there's this tendency just to let go and not hold on with passion. A sense of dispassion arises towards these experiences. So it's not something that one has to force oneself into, but it's one that through just clearly seeing, with clear understanding, it's the natural result. So this picking up and letting go, I think, it's just something we do through all layers and levels of the practice, again, as the different actions that we pick up and let go of, for better, for worse, for the development of mind states, skillful mind states, peaceful mind states, happy mind states, the development of the qualities of gladness and serenity, skillful mind states that relax and open and deepen the stillness that we can experience, letting go of those factors that obstruct it, picking up and letting go of skillful perceptions around the three characteristics that really then deepen our understanding. So we pick up those skillful ones and we let go of unskillful ways of speculation about different forms of existence or the different qualities that lead us into confusion, letting go of those, and picking up skillful reflections, and using your own experience to judge the results. Is it leading to peaceful contemplation? Is it leading to deeper states of tranquility in the mind? Is it leading to relinquishment, to seeing clearly, to disenchantment, to dispassion, to letting go? And if that's the case, then you can have a pretty good sense that you're moving in the right direction. And to nurture those qualities, to keep coming back, nurturing that space of mind that leads in that very fruitful direction. And I think the opportunity on a retreat, more than halfway, this is a real good time before the mind starts leaping into endings and going on to whatever is after the retreat. This is a real important time in the retreat to just reflect on these kinds of things and to enjoy it and to enjoy the peacefulness and stillness that can arise from these kinds of contemplations. So I'll leave it there for this afternoon.